It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One, cool, calm, heads, honest questions, and then decisive action. That's what we need before World War III. Two, the womb of a conspiracy. NBC, The New York Times, FTX, and Paul Pelosi, the birthplace of conspiracy theories. Three, self-reflection. Carrie Lake failed, and therefore she will fail to declare an invasion. Greg Abbott won, and he also, therefore, fails to declare an invasion. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment, Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. Share the link, share the file, share the good word with your friends. You can also watch the Will Cain Podcast on Rumble or on YouTube. The world seems to be going to hell in a handbasket in a day. News is flying fast. Missiles being launched, landing in Poland. Article 5 of NATO promises World War III. Donald Trump and his announcement potentially for president await us tonight. Perhaps, as well, although not literally, we are figuratively on the verge of a Republican civil war. Conspiracies abound, from Paul Pelosi to FTX. What's true and what is false? And then, why did I fail? In some of my estimation, for example, of who I thought was the next big star of the Republican Party, in Carrie Lake. It's a serious time in the news, and I'm going to do my best to be with you through the confusion, through the complexity. I'm going to do my best at all times to always be an honest broker. I'm serious. This is difficult to see our way through it, to not, honestly, indulge in first take, to be smart, to be right, to be humble. I'm going to do my best. And that's what I hope to start and begin with you here today. So let us start with the seriousness and the humility this deserves. I finally won in fantasy football. I'm no longer 0-9 in perhaps the biggest story of the week. And of course, for anybody taking themselves too seriously, I don't. So let's just take a moment of unseriousness and relax for this deep breath. I'm 1-9. And there's a little bit of me that's sad that I didn't go to 0-10. I mean, as I've mentioned, I've been trying, and I'm not really coming from a place of lack of experience. I've played fantasy football for 20 years. I hosted Fantasy Football Now on ESPN. I've managed my roster. I've made trades. I'm on the waiver wire every week. I had the first pick in the draft in Jonathan Taylor, and yet I remained winless until Sunday. I beat Fox and Friends first co-host Carly Shimkus, all of, I believe, 7 months pregnant, for my first win of the season. How embarrassing for Carly. I mean, look, we're all going to give Carly a little bit of a pass, you know, whatnot with the pregnancy. But still, you lost to an 0-9 team, Carly. 0-9. That was me. It's pretty embarrassing. Of course I'm joking. That's just a little bit of good-natured trash talk. What's the point in being 1-9? How much cooler would it have been if I could have said, I went 0-13, 0-12 in fantasy football. Now I'm 1-9, and it's just another imperfect season. Like the Patriots going 15-1. You know, 0-16, much cooler than 1-15. So I won. I'm sorry, Carly. I really didn't even want the win. Now that we've had that little bit of fun. At my expense, not Carly's. Let's get serious for a minute. There's some serious news, not just metaphorically, but literally flying around the world as we speak. Let's do our best to weed our way through the complexity, the lies, the conspiracy, with our best at the straight arrow of honesty. Story number one. Reports yesterday that a Russian missile landed in Poland just on the southwestern edge of Poland, just on the other side of the Ukrainian border. Two missiles reportedly landed in Ukrainian, or rather in Polish territory. Farmland, small town, killed two Polish individuals. Sounded like a very bucolic scene before this violent explosion. I think these farmers were drying wheat. Now, Article 5 of the NATO Convention requires a commitment of mutual defense for any members of NATO. That includes both Poland and the United States of America. I thought it might be helpful for us to take a look at some of the words of Article 5. It reads as follows. The parties agree that an armed attack against one or more of them in Europe or North America shall be considered an attack against them all. And consequently, they agree that if such an armed attack occurs, each of them, in exercise of the right of individual and collective self-defense, recognized by Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, will assist the party or parties attacked by taking, individually or in concert, such action as it deems necessary, including the use of armed force, to restore and maintain the security of the North Atlantic area. The collective defense. From the beginning of this conflict between Ukraine and Russia, there's been an acknowledgement that it is dangerously close to the borders of NATO, that it is dangerously close to an invocation of Article 5, that it is dangerously close to a trigger for the United States of America. But literalism is not what is necessary, is not what is prudent. This is when you hope for, and I'm not being sarcastic, this is when you need sound leadership. First, we know very little at this point about the nature, the origination, or the final destination of these missiles. Apparently, as I am to understand it today, missiles can be tracked. They can see their point of origin. You can see where they're manufactured. They can see ultimately from where they were fired. Secondarily, we can find out whether or not they were shot down, altered course by Ukrainian defense. In short, what we can find out is, was this a deliberate attack by Russia on a member of NATO? Now, NATO, and what I just read to you, was developed in 1949. It was the primary aim of the North Atlantic Treaty. And it was a pact of mutual assistance to counter then the risk of the Soviet Union, who was looking to extend its control into Eastern Europe. The first point in understanding whether or not a true and prudent leader would invoke Article 5 is to assess whether or not this was deliberate by Russia. Secondarily, there is or should be a conversation about, and this is why this conversation would have been so important for every moment leading up to this moment, and if this is not the trigger, then it's important for every moment forward, what is the nature of Poland's commitment right now to this war between Russia and Ukraine? Look, we know Ukrainian troops are training in Poland. We know that Poland is a way station, a transport hub for weapons into Ukraine. We know that Poland is not an innocent bystander in this conflict, in this war between Ukraine and Russia. At what point then does Poland's actions pot commit the United States of America? Now, an honest broker would say, wait a minute, those things that are being done by Poland are also being done by the United States of America. So if Russia sees Poland as a belligerent and not as an innocent bystander, how does it see the USA? We are shipping arms to Poland. We are active behind the scenes in training up Ukrainian forces, in arming Ukrainian forces. We, it cannot be argued, are an innocent bystander. Therefore, at what point is Poland a provocation? And therefore, at what point is the United States a provocation to Russia? This is, of course, not some rudimentary, simplistic characterization of the United States as the bad guy and Russia as the good guy. This is only through the prism of saying what best serves the citizens of the United States of America. America first. Before we are triggered, and I don't mean that in the college campus metaphorical sense, but literally before we are triggered into World War III, the first step and every step along the way needs to have that deliberate, sober consideration. How does this protect, advance, and serve the interests of the United States of America? It cannot be shut down with Russian apologists. It cannot be shut down with conspiracy theory, as we'll talk about in just a few moments here on the Will Kane podcast. It can't meet the same level of discourse that every other important issue, including the shutting down of the entire world economy over the last couple of years and the control of our bodily health and choices, has been met with since 2019, since 2020. It cannot be met with that level of discourse when we're talking about nuclear annihilation, when we're talking about World War III. I have no expectation nor hope that you or I will find that discourse on CNN, on MSNBC, on NBC, on ABC. I don't know if we'll find it in the halls of Congress. I don't know if we'll find it from Republicans. I don't think we'll find it from Democrats. And I'm very, very skeptical we'll find it when it comes to the leader of the free world. If there is one job of the president of the United States, it is foreign policy. If there is one job, it is war for the president. That's why it's so important. Truly, this is why elections for presidency are so important. George W. Bush wants to be the education president. He ends up being the 9/11 president. Every president has plans. And every president falls short. Almost every president falls short of executing those plans in domestic policy. But presidents have power when it comes to war. Let us not just hope, let us force. And let us do our best to exhibit here together in this small little corner of the universe that we have in this conversation, to do our best to have an honest conversation about what promises to be potentially the most important of our lifetime for our children, for our grandchildren, for our empire, for the United States of America.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Story number two. The womb of a conspiracy theory. How they're born. The story around Paul Pelosi and FTX. Those stories are not connected on the surface. And they're only connected in their treatment by the mainstream media. But they both exhibit a warning sign for us when it comes to the conversation we just had about Ukraine and Russia. They both exhibit the characteristics that lead to the birth of conspiracy, because they both are dishonest conversations that shut down real questions. They both leave blank spaces to be filled. They both yell, shut up. They both push lies. They both hide the truth. And truthfully, they both reveal, whatever it may be, even if it's question marks, something much, much deeper. Let's talk about Paul Pelosi for just one moment. You know the story. We didn't talk about it much on the Will Kane podcast because to me, there was too little to know. Paul Pelosi was at home when he was attacked by a man named David DePapp. Police were called to the scene, and it was revealed that Pelosi had been attacked by a hammer with a man that was said to be disturbed, possibly homeless. And I was told to us by the mainstream media had indulged in right-wing conspiracy theories, election denial, whatever it may be. Just like, for example, in the killing of a black man by law enforcement, the details and the facts of the particular crime are quickly swept away, and sort of that house of sand or that foundation of sand becomes the foundation for a mansion of narrative. On top of it is built this idea that DePape was the product of MAGA Republicans, that what we're seeing here is an example of political violence. The DePape went through the house saying stuff like, "Where's Nancy?" echoing scarily the words that were said by quote-unquote insurrectionists in the Capitol on January 6th. They drew the connections far and wide. They built an extravagant mansion on this foundation of sand. Nancy Pelosi herself, President Joe Biden, used it as a rhetorical, a scantily supported by the facts story on which to build rhetorical, elaborate edifices that indicted half the country, that indicted not just MAGA Republicans, but really honestly in the end, and you know this to be true, anyone who dares say, "I disagree." You would then be an insurrectionist, and you are indistinguishable from David DePape. Now, in the wake of that, many people had questions. Wait a minute, this is weird. And it is weird. There were reports about whether or not both of them were in their underwear. That still seems to be unclear. Maybe that's not true now. How long DePape had been in there, whether or not Pelosi was in the bathroom when he called, how long they were all together, when the attack occurred, when did law enforcement arrive? It was all very confusing. And some of what was originally reported, both by the media and police, later looked to be untrue, according to official law enforcement sources and filings. But some weird things began to happen. While big affirmative cases began to be built about whether or not they were in some type of tryst, for example, those affirmative cases weren't supported by the evidence. But the supporters of the grand narrative, the big rhetorical narrative I just described to you, the Pelosi's and Biden's of the world and their supporters in the media, began to dismiss not just those affirmative narratives, they began to dismiss questions about what happened as ugly indulgences of conspiracy. Look, I got that treatment by Geraldo Rivera on Media Buzz on the Fox News channel. But then NBC reported, NBC's, I believe the reporter's name was Miguel Almereda. Forgive me if I didn't get the name exactly right. He reported that when law enforcement arrived, DePape and Pelosi had not yet engaged. There was no yet assault that had been committed, and that law enforcement was let into the house. Now, this defied the official narrative, and it fed into some of the facts used to build larger affirmative cases that had been dismissed by as conspiracies. Quickly, NBC took the report down. Like, they took it down. They scrubbed it. And then they suspended the reporter. And for the last, I believe it's 12 days, he's been nowhere seen or heard. He's not tweeted since that time. And no one has said what exactly was wrong about the NBC report. It just vanished. Didn't fit the narrative. Now, let's put a little bit of context into this. This wouldn't be the first time NBC has altered a news story, meaning the editors step in and say that's not the narrative we're pushing forward. If you remember, back during the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin incident, NBC released some recordings of the 911 tape where George Zimmerman, seemingly unsolicited in the tapes, starts talking about Trayvon Martin's race, that he's black. What it's revealed later is that NBC editors within the building edited those 911 tapes to take out the 911 operator asking for George Zimmerman to describe the race of the perpetrator, in that case, Trayvon Martin. So Zimmerman was responding to a direct question, but it was edited by NBC to make it seem like, in short, that Zimmerman was racist. Whether or not he is, and that's not my case. It's just give me the facts and let me make up my own mind instead of editing and manipulating it to lead me to your conclusion. Which is take us back to the Pelosi case. NBC didn't like us having the facts and then arriving at our own conclusion. They wanted us to accept the narrative. And they disappeared the reporter, Miguel Amoreta, or whatever. And I'm not trying to say that disrespectfully. I don't have it in front of me. They disappeared the reporter and they disappeared the report. Fast forward 12 days to yesterday. NBC affiliate in San Francisco doing actual investigative journalism. This is fascinating. First of all, notice that the local San Francisco District Attorney's Office and law enforcement's file does not mesh with that of the DOJ. The DOJ's filings were used to dismiss all of these quote-unquote facts that led to conspiracy theories. However, there was conflict. The DOJ says officers showed up and walked in, let themselves into the house where a crime was being committed, the assault with the hammer. Local law enforcement says they arrived at the house. The two had been together. I believe they arrived 30 minutes after. They knew they were together. I don't really know why that is, but they arrive and Paul Pelosi lets in law enforcement. They talk to the two. Pelosi returns to standing by DePapp. And then somewhere in the interaction while law enforcement is there, then the assault with the hammer occurs. Okay, so who's right? Who's telling the truth? Conflicting facts. Well, NBC affiliate in San Francisco has a source, they claim, who's seen the police body cam footage, which would seem to be key. And that police body cam footage reveals, according to this NBC affiliate, that Paul Pelosi did let them into the house. And they did watch him return to standing next to DePapp. Now, what does all mean? I don't know. I'm not building the affirmative case. That's not the point. I don't support the affirmative case of running off to the fact that they were gay lovers. And I don't support the affirmative case of running off to this is a MAGA insurrectionist reflective of half of America. I think it supports the case of we deserve to know the facts. Who knows? Pelosi could be reacting to a crime in progress different than you would assume you or I would. We can't Monday morning quarterback being afraid somebody breaks in. I don't know. Maybe he's like, I just need to play it cool. Hopefully I can play it cool with law enforcement and keep everything calm. Who knows? But I do know that the facts were not available to me because the who knows isn't good enough when I have to support the official narrative. And thus is the birthplace of a conspiracy. Bravo to the local NBC affiliate for doing investigative journalism. Let us stay after this. Let us, as I promise in this show, be honest brokers in pursuit of the truth. Now let's move forward. I talked to you about FTX in the last episode of the Will Cain podcast. It's very complicated. I don't think we have time to go through all the details again, but long and short, FTX was a crypto trading platform that at this point it seems fairly clear was indulged in criminal activity, stealing money from its depositors, you and me, little small investors out there, stealing money from them, backdooring that money to its founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, for him to use however he wants, supporting his investments, supporting his hedge fund, supporting his political candidates, donating hundreds of millions to Democratic and Republican. His partner CEO donated to Republican candidates. He donated overwhelmingly to Democratic candidates. And then, of course, there's the question about the relationship with Ukraine, which we talked about in the last episode with Jeffrey Tucker. But here's the point for today. The New York Times puts up a piece on Sam Bankman-Fried. The New York Times puts up a piece. Let me pull it up. I had it pulled up on my phone just zeroed it out as I'm sitting here. The New York Times puts up a piece wherein they talk about who is Sam Bankman-Fried. And in that piece, they not once mention how he went about taking these people's money. He not once mentions crime, fraud, theft, or any of the such. The headline is How Sam Bankman-Fried's Crypto Empire Collapsed. It says Mr. Bankman-Fried said in an interview he had expanded too fast and failed to see the warning signs. He shared a few details about his handling of FTX's customer funds. He granted an interview for this puff piece. Trung Phan, who writes on business, put together a great tweet thread on this. He said this, in the New York Times piece on SBF, how many times was the word fraud mentioned? Zero. How many times was the word Enron mentioned? Zero. Crime, zero. Illiquid, zero. Stolen, zero. Hidden, zero. Criminal, zero. Backdoor, zero. Quote, he's getting sleep, mentioned once. This is what the New York Times considered appropriate to write. These weren't simply transfers. That's what he goes on to say. They described these as transfers, shifts in money. This was theft. This was stolen. And this is the New York Times whitewashing a crime from one of the Democratic Party's biggest donors. Was it a money laundering scheme for Ukraine? I don't know. I don't have to, nor do I think it's my job yet to build the affirmative case. It is everyone's job. And at one time, they gave Pulitzers to places like the New York Times for doing the job of asking the question. I mean, this is politics, the highest offices of the land. This is finance, and this is potential war all mixed together. And the best you can do is he's getting some sleep. This is the birthplace of conspiracy theories. And by the way, I don't use the word conspiracy theory derisively or dismissively, because conspiracy theorists, boy, they've been on a hot run. It's the same type of crap that has been pushed forward to shut people up about asking questions that we now know was right. When it comes to the origins of COVID, when it comes to the efficacy of the vaccine, when it comes to the efficacy of ivermectin, when it comes to the efficacy of masks, when it comes to the detrimental effects of putting masks on school children. And I could keep going on because it's the go-to rebuttal, the go-to dismissal, the go-to insult, the go-to muzzle to yell conspiracy theory. Do not let it happen. To circle back to our first story, in the words of Jen Psaki, to circle back to our first story, do not let it happen when it comes to nuclear war. I did see an interesting meme. Russia, Poland, and Germany called before the principal. The principal saying, why is it when it comes to world wars, it's always you three? Do not let hard questions be dismissed as conspiracy. Don't make them push you to the maximalist affirmative case. That's how the truth is often hidden. Oh, you want the facts around who opened the door and how long Paul Pelosi and David DePape were together? Well, you think it was a big gay orgy and you are a conspiracy theorist. Push them to the maximalist conspiracy so that you can dismiss the actual truth. Find the truth with the hard questions. And as long as they continue to cover it up, they will be the birthplace of conspiracy.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Story number three. Carrie Lake failed, so she'll fail to declare an invasion. Greg Abbott succeeded. He won, and so he fails to execute the declaration of an invasion. I'm committed to doing my best to understanding the American electorate. I'm much more interested in that these days than telling the American electorate what it should think. I thought Carrie Lake, I may still think, that Carrie Lake is a star politically. We've talked about it. I did a whole episode on breaking down what it is that makes Carrie Lake so palatable, so interesting, such a high ceiling. But this week, the state of Arizona was called for Katie Hobbs, Democrat, for governor. The state of Arizona seems to have selected Hobbs over Lake, and I have to. In all self-reflection and honesty, and not to be some type of concessionary moderate, but somebody who needs to have control in their life. I know that. And control as measured by how can I make a situation better, not sit on the sidelines and complain. Have to assess why Carrie Lake failed. Now, there are many that brought up You know, there are people talking about election interference. I don't see that evidence yet. There are others who I think have a smarter take talking about the advances of the Democratic Party in using mail-in balloting. And it's absolutely true. Ballot harvesting, going and bringing ballots in. And that politics these days, as laid out by many, I think Charlie Kirk and Mike Cernovich, is as much about machinery as it is about campaigning. Do you have the ground forces in the age of mail-in ballot to go get them back? And I think it's a really smart take, and it's a very important lesson in taking control for anyone aligned with conservative values and in support of the Republican Party to understand those are now the rules of the game. Maybe you can fight to change those rules, but you're going to have to play by them and try to win. But I don't think that explains the loss by Kari Lake. And here's why. So many other Republicans won in Arizona. Outside of Blake Masters for senator and Kari Lake for governor, the attorney general, many House races, Republicans were embraced in Arizona. So why were Masters and Lake rejected? I don't know. Is it because they readily took up the case of the election in 2020? I do think that voters are largely done hearing about that. I do. I'm not telling you right or wrong. I think it's about fatigue. I don't know. Is that it? I've heard some people say to me, and I didn't see it, but I've heard people say, I don't know. Lake has an edge that can come off as angry. And I don't think we fully appreciate how often politics is simple. I had some buddies talking to me about this. In the end, all it's about is, do you like the guy and do you want to have a beer with him? Like, I liked a lot of Blake Masters' ideas, most of them, to be quite honest. And then they'd say to me, what does Blake Masters make you feel? What is his image? Do you want to have a beer with Blake Masters? Again, I'm not telling you the way I think it should work. I'm trying to analyze the way it does work. And there must be something simple, something on the surface, that voters in Arizona said, not for me, when it comes to Lake and Masters. And one of Lake's big promises, even if I didn't see it, even if I still think that she's potentially a star, but one of Lake's first promises was she would declare an invasion along the southern border to deploy state resources to solving our crisis at the southern border. Interestingly, yesterday, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas did just that, at least on the surface. He declared an invasion wherein he said the following. He authorizes, Greg Abbott said, I invoke the invasion clause of the U.S. and Texas Constitution to fully authorize Texas to take unprecedented measures to defend our state against an invasion. I'm using that constitutional authority and executive orders to keep our country safe. Here's what he said he would do. Deploy the National Guard to safeguard our border and to repel and turn back immigrants trying to cross the border illegally. Deploy Texas DPS to arrest and return to the border immigrants who crossed illegally and arrest illegal immigrants for criminal activity. 3, build a border wall. 4, deploy gunboats. He goes on. At first, you're like, wow, Greg Abbott just declared the invasion that many have asked for, to deploy state resources to controlling the problem at the southern border to deport illegal immigrants. This is where language becomes so important, and politicians can be slick. I don't know if Greg Abbott's being slick. I'd love for him to come on here and tell me. But let's focus on the words. Deploy Texas DPS to arrest and return to the border. Return to the border. Immigrants who crossed illegally. I'm not the only one that caught that language. Ken Cuccinelli, president of the Center for Renewing America, who's led this effort to declare an invasion, says on Twitter, I appreciate Governor Abbott, but his invasion comments today are just that, comments. Unless Texas put invaders back into Mexico, not take them to the border and not hand them over to CBP, their efforts will not drive down border crossing numbers in Texas. Russ Vaught said the same thing. He said the Texas legislature is probably going to have to force Greg Abbott to do the invasion strategy the right way. All eyes will be on Texas. It doesn't matter unless you deport illegal immigrants. Does Texas and Texas DPS have that authority? That's the point of declaring an invasion, to invoke constitutional authority. Would it lead to a showdown between Border Patrol and Texas DPS? Possibly. But let's be clear. This is a failure to execute the strategy of declaring an invasion. No one cares if you take illegal immigrants back to the border. You have to take them back across the border. They have to be deported. I welcome Governor Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, whoever, onto this program to explain to me exactly what they will do and whether or not this is action or rhetorical trick, whether or not this is leadership or, after a win to be reelected governor of Texas, failure to execute the strategy of declaring an invasion on the southern border. A lot of news. Big, heavy day. I didn't go through Will's weekly quarterback depth chart. It would include Tua. There seems to be some debate about whether or not Tua Tagovailoa is actually, at this point, a top five quarterback. Oh, yeah. He is. I'll get back to that and my picks of the week when I join you again on Friday. As I said, I hope this was, and I hope we will continue to be, a place that we can sort through to the best of our ability this confusing time, as is possible, the most honest brokers. Download, rate, review, leave me a comment. I'll hear what you have to say, and I hope you'll leave us a 5-star review and share this episode and this show with your friends. Amazon Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. I'll see you next time on the Will Cain Podcast.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.